And good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to The Other Side of Midnight. That kind of magical time between dusk and dawn where the things we look at in daytime and say, oh, come on, that could never happen. During this time of night, you kind of take a second look and you say, show me more. Show me more. Well, we're going to show you more this morning. My very special guest this morning is someone I've wanted to interview on the radio, on this side of the mic, for decades, and it's now finally happened. Stanton Friedman is here. Known to his friends as Stan, or Stanton. I've never met a Stanton. I know a couple of Stans, Stan Tenen for one. So Stan and I had a conversation a few moments ago, and I said, how would you like me to call you, Stan or Stan? He says, either one, either way. So we might just mix it up this evening. Okay, tonight is February 1. Actually, it's February 2. It's just across the other side of midnight from February 1. And on the other side of midnight, that other side, way over there, back there in time, speeding away in our cone of whatever you want to call it, is the Iowa caucus. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time tonight talking about Iowa, but I am tomorrow night, and I'm going to invite all of you to help me because you are watching, we are watching, we are immersed in, as I tried to say on the show from the beginning, when we talk about politics, and nothing happens without politics, as Stanton and I are going to talk about, you know, nothing's happened in the UFO community for decades and decades and decades officially because of politics. Politics is basically people relationships. How do people get along? How do they codify their behavior? How do they act so that they don't impugn on each other's rights? You know, my rights end, you know, at the end of my arm and your nose and that kind of thing. So tomorrow night we're going to talk about Iowa in the context of disclosure, in the context of what Steve Bassett and I have talked about on the show a couple, three times. We're going to talk about it in terms of the physics, the force, the hyperdimensional model. It's really fascinating tonight that the distance between Hillary and Bernie is literally impossible to see from this distance. The percentage is like 0.01 or something. They're literally dividing the electorate on that side of the aisle in half. And on the other half, on the other side, Senator Cruz was able to come up with 28%, and Donald Trump came up with 24%, and Marco Rubio 23%, 24%, 28%. It's going to be remarkably intriguing to talk about that and what it really means tomorrow night. So we'll do all that tomorrow night. You know, we'll also talk about anything else you want to talk about. But this marks a moment in history because, as I've said on this show before, the physics which allowed us to predict in 2007 that Barack Obama was going to be elected president, that same physics now says it's not going to be Hillary. And it may not be Trump. It may be, this is so symbolic. And anyway, I don't want to spend a lot of Stanton's time talking about this, but tomorrow night is going to be very interesting. Moving on, we have two birthday guys tonight to talk about. Pat Barton and Keith Laney, both good old boys down in the South, one in Georgia, one in South Carolina. They have birthdays. And I'm not going to tell you how old they are because, frankly, I don't know. And it's irrelevant because a birthday is a marker. It's a spin around the sun. It's a happy birthday, guys, and welcome to our community, our extended family. Both have made very important contributions and will make more. So that brings me to tonight's topic and tonight's guest. There are many times in this business when they say things like, well, so-and-so is so famous, he needs no introduction. Well, frankly, I'd like to read you Stanton's introduction because it's pretty impressive and it's the important backdrop to the conversation I want to have tonight, which is not about nuts and bolts, but about big picture. Stanton has been doing this for longer than a lot of us have been around, and I want to kind of get a sense from him tonight. How much more time is he planning to spend doing this way as opposed to maybe changing tactics and strategies and all that kind of stuff? So, nuclear physicist lecturer Stanton Friedman received his BSc and MSc degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 1956. I wonder if he knows Turkovich. Stanton was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist by such companies as GE, GM, Westinghouse, CRW Systems, Aerojet General, McDonnell Douglas, etc., working on such highly advanced and classified, but eventually even canceled programs as the nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and various compact nuclear power plants for space and terrestrial applications. Stanton became interested in UFOs in 1958, and obviously I'm going to ask him what triggered that interest. And since 1967, has been lecturing about the more than 600 colleges and 100 professional groups in 50 U.S. states, 10 Canadian provinces, 18 other countries in addition to various nuclear consulting efforts. He's showing no signs of slowing down. Stanton's published more than 90 UFO papers and has appeared on hundreds of radio and television shows, including Larry King in 2007, and Larry King again twice in 2008, many, many documentaries. He is the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident, co-authored Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. Top Secret / Magic, his controversial book on the Majestic 12, established in 1947 to deal with alien technology, was published in 1996 and has gone through 6 printings. Well, I could go on and on and on and on and on and on. The last thing I'll say is Stanton T. Friedman is a dual citizen of the USA and Canada. So if Senator Cruz is leading tonight in the Republican nomination race for the presidency, maybe Stanton could jump in. Good morning, Stanton.
Good morning, indeed. And for the benefit of your listeners, it's really morning here. It's 4 a.m. I'm constantly having to tell, especially media types, who want to do an interview, that I'm 4 hours ahead of California. Oh, you can't be. It's only 3 hours on the East Coast. Well, I'm east of Maine, and I'm 4 hours ahead. We have our own time zone, the Atlantic time zone.
Amazing.
If you want a strange time zone, you go to Newfoundland. That's east of us, and they're a half hour ahead of us. And most Americans have no idea where Newfoundland is or that it's half hour ahead of us.
But Of course not.
And okay. I'm back here. I want to correct a false impression that was given by some nasty, noisy negativists that I was living in California until 1980. Well, I lived a few other places in between working on these canceled programs. But I moved here not because I was chased out by the FBI or the CIA or people like that. It so happens my wife is from New Brunswick, and she's one of 9 children. 6 of them live back here. Her parents live back here. We brought our kids from the West Coast, and they came here. They had cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and I had a backup system while I was out of town. And I've never regretted to move to beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada. A little cold in the winter, but the University of New Brunswick is here. Great place to raise a family. Great lobsters, too, incidentally.
Wow. Well, I grew up living in New England, so I'm not unfamiliar with snow. Actually, we had much more snow in England when I was growing up there than we have had out here in the West. You know, here, it's kind of like D.C. If we get 2 inches of snow, everything just stops.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. The great American Southwest, you put 2 inches of snow on a freeway, and they absolutely come to a dead halt. In fact, what they do is they close the freeways, and they divert all the traffic to the surface road, so everybody who was stuck getting home on the freeway, they're now stuck permanently in these side villages, and they have to, you know, go into the inns and the bed and breakfast, basically, to survive overnight. It's a very interesting system here in New Mexico. So,
well, yeah, it is. I spent a lot of time there.
I mean, Roswell. You know, it's so funny, because other than Roswell, and Robin and I have been down there many times, The UFO culture, if I can call it that, doesn't seem to have permeated the rest of the state. It's like Roswell has this bubble. You've got the research folks up north, the Sandy and whatever. They're totally on a different planet. There's no cross interest or connection between extraterrestrial stuff out of Roswell and extraterrestrial stuff out of Sandia, and it's like this bubble, this time warp took place in 1947, and almost nothing seems, Stan, to have changed in decade after decade after decade. Where is this field tonight? Tell me, as the guy who probably has the best credentials to look back and look forward, where are we, and is Stephen Bassett's fabled disclosure ever going to come?
I don't really expect it will. One new New Mexico aspect of this is the just released, well, actually, January now, new book, The Aztec UFO Incident, by Scott Ramsey, his wife Suzanne Ramsey, and Frank Thayer is a PhD, and I wrote a preface for it.
Okay.
This just came out, Career Press. And, you know, for many, many years, Aztec, which is in the northwest corner of New Mexico, right in the Four Corners area, out in the middle of nowhere, you might say.
How far is it from Chaco,
Well, it was sort of the laughing stock of ufology. After all, that was a phony story, blah, blah, blah. It didn't really happen. Well, it turns out it did happen. And this is one of the best researched books on UFOs of any kind, but especially on crash saucer stories of any. Scott and Suzanne spent a ton of money. They were fortunate one way. Suzanne's family is from the Aztec area. So they had entree to people that a lot of other people wouldn't get a chance to talk to.
So were they just, you know, people living in the state, or do they have a journalism background, or are they scientists, or are they intrigued?
Well, Scott's big thing is selling wire for generators and all that sort of stuff. He's a salesman of a technology product. Suzanne, as a matter of fact, was doing a regular radio interview show when she met Scott. He did her show. I've done her show. This is several years ago. And they eventually got married. And I really don't know of any other big couples.
I was going to say, it almost sounds to me like Aztec brought them together.
Oh, it did. There's no question about that.
Hmm.
And they're both special people. And so I'm satisfied, and that's why I wrote the preface, that indeed there was a crash, a recovery, a big vehicle. And Scott's thorough, so Suzanne. And they did something. People say, well, how could a big, this thing was supposedly 100 feet in diameter, how could you move that any place? Well, it turns out Scott hired a guy whose job it is to figure out how to move large pieces of, say, electrical gear. Big generators don't go sailing down the road.
So the idea here is that when this thing crashed in 47?
Yes.
That the Army...
I know, 48.
Okay, the Army moved in, and they secretly moved it away on some kind of flatbeds or whatever, and the critics say, how could you move a 100-foot-wide spaceship? And you're saying that this guy, Scott, actually has expertise in moving very heavy loads.
No, it's somebody he hired.
Oh, okay, okay.
It was taken apart, apparently. But they went down the old maps. And, you know, you're always looking for clog points, you know. Whoops, can't get across that bridge. It's not wide enough, et cetera.
Yeah, of course.
But they did that. Also, they found documents. They found an archive that had a lot of the papers of one of the chief actors in this whole business. And
nobody else knew about that. This is Scott and Suzanne who found these papers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And Frank Thayer, who's a PhD in New Mexico in Las Cruces, helped out a lot, too. So they spent an enormous amount of time and money. And, you know, people tend to forget. It takes money, I don't need to tell you, but it takes money to do research, to travel hither, thither, and yon, you know. And it takes time. And time is money, too, because, you know, how do you earn your living while you're spending your time trying to find witnesses from something that happened way long ago. So that's the latest development, and I'm very impressed with it, and I'm glad that I wrote the preface. I don't know what the difference is between a preface and a foreword.
I think it's all in that mysterious world of the editorial. Let's go back to 58. It says in your bio, your quick, you know, kind of snapshot bio, that you got intrigued with this in 58. Well, Sputnik hit us in 57. What could have been more exciting than Sputnik? How did you get into the whole UFO thing under the huge news umbrella of humans launch first spacecraft?
Well, remember, there wasn't anybody on that first Sputnik.
True.
It was a satellite in the sky.
But it caused
one hell of a
ruckus.
It was very unexpected and so forth. I was working as a nuclear physicist for General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, GEAMP, Cincinnati. And my wife and I were often ordered books from I think it was Marlboro, discount bookstores send stuff, catalogs out, and you order and you buy books. We had made up a list of books we wanted, and I needed one more book so I wouldn't have to pay shipping.
Oh, that old thing. Okay.
So, looking down the list, and there was one. Oh, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Air Force Captain Edward J. Ruppelt. Mm. And he had headed Project Blue Book in the early 50s. And here was a hardcover book marked down from $2.95 to $1. Believe it or not, I still have it. It's hard to find a hardcover book for $1. I figured, A, it wasn't costing me anything because the shipping charges would have been $1. B, the Air Force was co-sponsor of our ANP program, so I respected the Air Force. C, gee, if these things were real and used nuclear energy, that would help our program, I should think. I didn't have an opinion about whether they're real or not because I didn't know anything. I've got this crazy notion you shouldn't express opinions and you don't know what you're talking about.
So you simply had listened to news reports and radio stuff and you knew what the general public knew.
Yeah, no big deal. And I was much more excited by working on nuclear airplanes, frankly, because I had a chance to do a lot of experiments. And I should stress now, many people have this picture of a research and development program is, six professors and 20 grad students and, at some university. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Our program in 1958, a long time ago, spent $100 million that year, employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. That's a big program. It wasn't six professors.
No.
And we did experiments.
And $100 million in those days was what, a couple of billion now?
Well, it was a lot of money, a respectful amount of money, let's put it that way. I did experiments with exotic materials, lithium hydride, beryllium oxide, gadolinium hydride, crazy stuff, if you will. It was fascinating. And I did experiments. We built a facility at Oak Ridge, the tower shielding facility, that would allow you to bring a reactor shield assembly up 200 feet off the ground. Obviously, if you're flying a nuclear-powered airplane, you have radiation being put out, and you want to know what the effect of the ground is, and you want to know, is the pilot going to get hit by radiation that scatters from the reactors at the back of the plane? The radiation goes out and scatters off the air and hits the pilot at the front. It's a complicated problem. Anyway, so that was exciting, and I learned a heck of a lot.
Did you guys work at
all?
In
my education, I hadn't learned anything about the crazy materials like the ones I mentioned.
Or the things that nuclear radiation would do to them.
Well, you worry about that. But remember, we're all exposed to radiation all the time. There is a background here.
Right.
But we're talking,
yeah, but we're talking reactor-level radiation, not background. So in 58, you're a technically smart guy. You're involved in some of the most cutting-edge stuff this country is funding. Nuclear-powered aircraft really were Buck Rogers stuff back then. Did you guys talk with the folks that were working on NERVA, the nuclear rocket?
Well, that was later. That was NERVA. I moved. They notice in my introduction there, a lot of canceled programs. I spent 3 years at GE, saw the handwriting on the mall, got a job out on the West Coast, Aerojet General Nucleonics, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, it was nut groves back then. It's wall-to-wall housing now, San Ramon. And there, I worked on developing a small reactor for space vehicle applications because it's a great way to produce energy. If you want to use a laser weapon or do other things like that, or sideband radar, solar power isn't very effective in terms of how big a system you need to produce.
Oh, it's so dilute, yeah.
So, I was involved in a study of fusion propulsion. Our director of research was
for aircraft?
No, for rockets.
Oh, for rockets. Okay. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Fusion, yeah, okay.
Yeah, we're moving toward rockets here. So fusion, what happened was the man who became our director of research was a man named John Luce, and he had headed the research at Oak Ridge National Laboratory on fusion. John is a remarkable guy, high school diploma, 40 patents, and he got an honorary PhD in physics. Brilliant man, really knew what he was doing when it comes to working with people. And we got a contract. We spent $9 million looking at fusion for deep space travel. And the thing about fusion, and people, we've got an anti-nuclear bias. Craft that just went by Pluto.
Yep.
A few months ago, it took over 9 years to get there. All that time, its power was coming from a nuclear device, radioisotope thermoelectric generator. It's not solar power. You get away from the Earth, you go out, and solar power decreases, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, fusion. To give you an idea of the progress, I put that in quotes. That man is made. In 1944, a big bomb was a 10-ton blockbuster. It took a huge B-29, huge for the time,
yep,
to carry it. It released the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. It was called a 10-ton blockbuster. And they make big holes in the ground. And, you know, people forget, and maybe they're all dead or remembered, except us old guys, really old guys like me. During the war, we destroyed 1,700 cities. 1,700 cities. We bombed the hell out of.
Isn't that something to be proud of?
Well, I'm not saying as if I were proud of it.
No, I didn't say that you were. I'm just saying the human race, you know, when we look back on the history of who we are and what we've done, I mean, that's a big part of who we are, isn't it, Stan? Is that maybe why out there are keeping us on a reservation? I mean, look, let's short-circuit this. You were involved in the most interesting high-tech stuff at the time. But you had background in UFOs, and then you got this book. At what point did you put the two ideas together? Wait a minute, there may be guys with sexier technology on the block that I can get access to.
Well, I read the book. I shared it with a neighbor. Charlie was an engineer, a good one, 10 years older than I was. And he was more impressed with the book than I was. I was interested, but didn't know what to make of it. But moved to California and had a good librarian, wound up reading 10 books, some of which were garbage, and if I'd read them first, I'd have never read another one. And then I had my epiphany at the University of California, Berkeley Library, a second course on campus and worked not far away. I found a copy of something that hadn't been mentioned in any of the books that I'd read, Project Blue Book, Special Report number 14. And it doesn't normally get mentioned in the anti-UFO literature. And what really shocked me, I mean, I'm a data hound, and there were 200 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. You know, I was in data heaven. But the guy included the press release, a guy named Dr. Leon Davidson. A press release had gone out in 55, but they hadn't distributed the book, the volume, if you will.
Right.
And so...
So were these numbers sequential reports, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 14?
Well, at that time, I only had 14. And what shocked me was it hadn't been mentioned in any of the books that I had read.
Huh.
And which, you know, how come? And then the fact that the disconnect between the press release, which quoted the Secretary of the Air Force, you can't get to a higher authority than that.
No.
He said, quote, "On the basis of this study, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available." So, no problem. Nothing to it. Well, I had the volume in front of me, and as I said, I'm a data hound, and where does that come from? The Secretary of the Air Force was lying through his hat, and I don't say that.
So as a physicist, you looked at the report and you said, wait a minute, there's all kinds of really amazing, impossible things here, and the Secretary has just lied to me that there's nothing interesting here.
Yeah, well, when I say, let me be specific. He said the unknown 3%. The unknowns, they looked at 3,201 sightings. That's a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that 21.5% could not be unidentified. Now, 21.5% is not 3 rounded off.
No.
As you may have noticed. They did a quality evaluation of all the sightings. The better the quality of the sighting, the more likely to be unidentifiable. They asked an obvious question. We got tons of data here. On the basis of 6 different observable characteristics, things like apparent size, color, shape, speed, that sort of thing, they found that the probability that the unknowns, the only ones we're interested in,
sure,
were just missed knowns, was less than 1%.
And the Secretary of the Air Force just kind of didn't mention that.
No, he didn't mention that. The press release not only didn't mention that, they didn't quote any data from the report.
So
but they
didn't
give the title of the report.
So what now, the Secretary was doing was exactly what the Condon Committee did a decade or two later. I mean, when I read some of the raw reports of the Condon Committee and looked through, and we'll get into what Condon is in a minute, I had a breakfast conversation with Alan Hynek at the Hay Adams Hotel in Washington right after the report came out. And I said to him, how in the world could they claim with a straight face this is science when their own report reported such wondrously anomalistic behavior by official tracking cameras and, you know, all kinds of official Air Force.
They had 30% unknowns,
yeah,
according to a special committee set up by the world's largest group of space scientists, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics.
So this was your baptism. So this was your baptism not only into the peculiarities of the technical aspect, but also that the U.S. government on this subject had a tendency not to want to talk about it.
Well, yeah, I was really bound and determined. I don't like being lied to, especially by somebody at as high a level as the Secretary of the Air Force. I mean, look, working under security, sometimes you have to tiptoe around the truth, but that's different from blatant lying. So I was bound and determined I was going to find out more. I joined APRO and NICAP. It was lunchtime conversation with my colleagues, brown bagging it, you know. And then I still hadn't said anything public, really. And then another job change moved. They canceled the program I was working on in California at Aerojet General Nucleonics. And I was hired by General Motors Allison Division in Indianapolis to work on the military compact reactor program. This would be a device that you'd carry around in an airplane, set it up out in the middle of nowhere, and produce electrical power, because everybody needs electrical power.
Mm.
And I was working on radiation shielding, because an important part of any nuclear system is you need to protect the people around. And your shielding can't be so heavy that you can't get the thing off the ground if you're going to fly.
That's right. Okay, tell me, we're at the bottom of the hour. Hold it there. My guest this morning,
okay,
the very special, the very interesting, the very persistent, Stanton Friedman. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we're talking about Americans looking at a space frontier simultaneous with something unusual coming in from where? Outer space? We'll get to what Stanton did after he decided this was a problem worthy of his efforts when we return.
Like a bride and a groom, we'll always stand united. We will not be divided. There's too much to lose. Blue are the waters surrounding the brave. Patriots from sea to shining sea. Selfish courage of fighters charging in, and now they're lost. Why the lifesaver's armor?
And we are back with my guest this morning, Stanton Friedman. Stanton, when you realize you'd been lied to, that you're looking at data and you're looking at a press release and the two don't match, what did you decide to do? Because, you know, one guy, I'm kind of been at this one guy investigation business for a while. One guy by himself is pretty kind of useless. You got to get a network. You got to get sources. You got to basically crack through a cover-up, if there is one, how did you as a physicist begin to look at the political problem of the political lies in the face of the documents?
I tried to get more information by joining APRO and NICAP, and then when I moved to Indianapolis, it turns out that my timing was good. Frank Edwards was living there, and he wrote the book Flying Saucer: Serious Business, and he was a journalist.
Oh, he was a huge star in the 1950s.
This is in the 60s, yes.
Yeah, 50s, 60s. He was the big, he was kind of like, Walter Winchell and one of those?
Well, yeah, that sort of thing. He was a journalist. He had a program. He was an officer in NICAP, incidentally.
Oh, okay.
And so I got him to speak to a group, Hemophilia Society chapter, and I was moving. That program got canceled, so I joined Westinghouse
Stan,
Astronaut.
Did you ever get
lab.
The idea that maybe you shouldn't join a program because you were not good luck for it?
No, I don't worry about that. I'm not the rat leaving the sinking ship,
okay.
You know.
I just look at patterns. Go ahead.
Well, I asked Frank. I got a job with Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab in Pittsburgh working on the NERVA program that you mentioned.
Okay.
Nuclear rocket engine.
Yep.
And I asked Frank, I said, I want to go public. You know everybody, Frank. Give me some names. So he gave me some names. And one of them was the producer of a radio show at KDKA Pittsburgh, which is the big media station in town.
Oh, huge.
And one was the producer of a show called Contact, believe it or not. And I think it's still on there. And I called the producer, because I had his name from Frank, and thinking that, look, Westinghouse, if you you're a nuclear physicist working for Westinghouse, those are gold-plated credentials. You want to buy a house, how much money you want to borrow, you know, that sort of thing. Because Pittsburgh is a Westinghouse town, you might say. and his response
that,
is...
That and U.S. Steel.
Well, and Gulf Research Labs and Alcoa, it was a big town, but Westinghouse was certainly big, the nuclear submarine people and so forth. And so his response at the station was, don't call us, we'll call you, which surprised me a bit, but okay. A month later, they called me, would you believe, at 6:30, could I do the 7 o'clock show, please? I lived near the station. Somebody had canceled at the last minute, and I have no idea how many dozen people they called before they finally got to me, you know.
Was there some
kind of an
incident? Been a sighting? Had the Air Force knocked down something?
No, nothing at all like that. The guy who was supposed to be on the show talking about something else had canceled, and they needed entertainment.
So it was the luck of the draw. They just said, if we can find a nuclear physicist who knows something about UFOs, can we put him on and...
No, can we find somebody who's willing to spend the time tonight? We're desperate for a guest.
Okay.
So I went on, and...
But KDKA was a huge station.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
I think it was the first station in the United States, I think.
It was one of the first. Yeah. It was one of those clear channel 50,000-watt stations.
Yeah, so, no, that's not like my little, you know, Dew-line station and... You know, the boondocks of New England.
No.
This was a big deal, Stan. This was God reaching down and saying, Stanton Friedman, yes, this is your opportunity. Don't blow it.
Well,
so what did you do?
I did the program. I wasn't quite as good as handling the nasty, noisy negativist then as I am now, but somebody at work at Westinghouse heard me on the program. And they had a big audience. And called me and said, hey, could you talk to our book review club? We're reading Frank's book. And maybe you'd give us a talk about UFOs. Well, okay, I'll give that a shot.
So the kind of networking we'd assume, if intelligent people see something that's really different and interesting, backed up by evidence, was moving along.
Yeah, it was moving along indeed. And I did that show, and I did that lecture. And I did the show again and did other lectures, and then fate took a hand, you could say. One day of two in a three-year period where I lived downtown Pittsburgh, and Westinghouse Astronuclear Laboratory was out in a small town called Large, out of town.
Mm-hmm.
So my car was in the garage. I was driving in with a woman who, Joanne, who was a supervisor at Westinghouse, PhD from Caltech, Carnegie Tech, sorry. And we're talking, and I asked, I said, gee, I'd love to speak to Carnegie Tech. Well, why don't you talk to the dean? Well, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. And give him a call. So I called her husband, Gene. I mean, with that kind of a recommendation, how could I not?
Exactly.
We agreed on a date about 3 weeks later, but it was an afternoon talk, which meant that I'd have to take some time off work. And so his last question was, how much do you want? And I thought, maybe I can get as much as 50. I'll ask for 100. So he bought the 100. But then because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in the series, $1,500.
Oh, my gosh. And back then, that was some money.
So, there's an eye-opener. So the talk went extremely well. He sent a letter to the agent through whom he had booked the other speakers, and they booked me at the Engineering Society of Detroit. That's not a lot of little old ladies in tennis shoes. That's the Engineering Society of Detroit. $300 plus expenses. And it turns out that was a real turning point. They were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk, and there wasn't one negative question. And that impressed the heck out of me.
And what year was this?
That would have been like 68.
68, okay.
Yeah, and then I had
another... So this is just before we go into orbit around the moon.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
With Apollo 8.
So people were getting excited about space. There's no question about that. But I did that talk, and then, again, somebody at work, I convinced, they were having a joint meeting of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics local section and the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, IEEE, in Pittsburgh. And I convinced the program chair, and I said, look, it won't cost you anything but dinner and a babysitter for my wife and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been having good crowds, been speaking a lot of places. Okay, so they booked me. And at dinner, there were 25 people at the hotel across from the speaking facility. And I thought, boy, did I lay an egg here. Well, we got over to the hall. It was already half full. We wound up with over 400 people. They had set a limit on how many people could come in. Again, there were all kinds of respectable people. My boss's boss, three levels up, I recognized. And there were no negative questions.
Hmm.
Now I'm beginning to get impressed by this. And so I asked Westinghouse, I need some guidelines. I don't want to lose my job. I don't want to lose my security clearance. Give me some guidelines. I've got a wife, a family, mortgage, et cetera.
You mean you asked your bosses? You asked your bosses what guidelines you should use in this discussion?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you think you might be bumping into some security concerns of some of the technology you're reading about was maybe us?
Well, one of the things that I worried about was not losing my security clearance.
Okay.
Because without that, nobody's going to hire me to do what I was doing.
Of course.
And so they came back to me with three rules. You can say what you please on your time. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. But we'd like you to put a disclaimer at the beginning. The views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer. Now, what more could you ask for? I mean, that's great. Well, I did ask for something more. I got a call from my shielding colleague, if you will, at Los Alamos on their NERVA program project. And he said, hey, Stan, I understand you're giving lectures. Would you talk to the American Nuclear Society section here in Los Alamos? Sure. Now, I mean, on an expense account, Stan, he's in New Mexico, I'm in Pittsburgh.
Mm.
I said, well, I don't make those decisions, so I'll go to management. And they came back to me, yeah. They paid my way to go from Pittsburgh to Los Alamos to give a lecture, flying saucers are real.
See, this is Dan. This is really important. I don't want to pass over this quickly because this is really interesting. Because in this time frame, the 1960s, late 1960s, as the U.S. was going to the moon and we're about to land Neil and Buzz on the lunar surface, you're employed by a major, major aerospace contractor, DOD, NASA, up the wazoo, Westinghouse, and they authorize you to go and talk to a bunch of nuclear physicists at the creme de la creme of nuclear research in the United States, which is Los Alamos, right, on the subject of aliens, ETs, flying saucers, and guys maybe visiting us, and nobody is saying no. You're always getting these positive, do more, do more.
We had over 500 people at the lecture, and again, no negative questions.
Well, this sounds eerily. Let me interrupt one thing. Are you familiar with my invitations to NASA to talk about Cydonia and the stuff in the solar system and all that?
Oh, I've been reading the miscellaneous collection of stuff about that.
Okay. Well, there's been repeated invitations, and I'm going to ask you the same question I've asked myself. After all these high mucky mucks want to see this data, nothing ever seems to happen. Stan, what happened to all your briefings? Why are we still in the position tonight that the U.S. government officially says we're all by ourselves?
Well, you know, you saw those articles a few weeks ago. These two guys from Australia saying we're the only civilization in the universe because they all die before they get advanced enough to produce the changes on the planet that are needed for life to develop. My column for the MUFON Journal, I just wrote one about that. Utterly ridiculous notion. Can you imagine anybody even hesitating to suggest that we can say that there is no life out there? And they didn't look at the question of anybody discovering us. You see, we're the big shots in the world, and if there's going to be life out there,
we'll find it.
We have to find it. Yeah, and I'll be back next week. I'm going to check out 10 planets, 10 planets the week after, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, utterly absurd notion. And, of course, and, you know, I'm famous for calling SETI, Silly Effort to Investigate, S-E-T-I.
Have you ever had a kind of... I know you did a debate George arranged on Coast with Seth Shostak. Have you ever, the two of you just got in a room and said, okay, let's level. What do you know? What do you know?
Well, not really. We were both on a Larry King show together, and more importantly, I guess, we each gave three lectures on the Queen Elizabeth II. We got a free trip from England, from the UFO magazine of England, from England to New York. So we each gave three lectures, and we each attended the other's lecture. I'm a little sneaky. I asked in the course of my lecture, how many people here have read this? I talk about five large-scale scientific studies, and I'm lucky if 2% have read any.
Right.
And, of course, Seth didn't raise his hand for any of them. I figure I'm not going to give a free sounding board for somebody who hasn't studied the evidence. I've had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, so I must be doing something right. Two of them were drunk, incidentally.
Okay.
And you're going to get that many if you talk about sports, religion, or politics, yep. I think you realize. And I don't worry about hecklers, but one of them, a typical example, in Pittsburgh again, the Gulf Research Labs, they're big there. Guy interrupted me two or three times, and the manager of the meeting, it was a dinner meeting, finally said, let him finish. You know, he said, why don't you talk about blah? And I said, I will be talking a second time, third time. Okay, so at the end of the lecture, I turned to him, and he says, well, I'm sure one could come to opposite conclusions than the ones you've come to. I said, well, as I recall now, you hadn't read any of those five large-scale scientific studies, right? Yes, that's correct. And so what's the difference between us, isn't it? I gave you my conclusions. I gave you the sources of the evidence on which I based those conclusions. I've read them all. You've read none of them. Whose opinion's worth more?
Mm.
There was a long silence.
This kind of reminds me of the time I was doing Charlie Rose, and I was debating Steve Squires, who was the principal investigator for the Athena
Cornell,
project.
Yeah,
Cornell, the two little Mars rovers, not Curiosity, but the previous, little Sojourner and Opportunity. And I'm debating him on Charlie Rose, and Charlie asks him the magic question. Dr. Squires, have you looked at Mr. Hoagland's book? Have you looked at any of the photographs he's describing? No. And that was it. That's when you win, when your opposition, in their academic
right.
insulation, prides themselves on not having contaminated themselves with your, I won't use the word, data.
Well, look, and another part of this same kind of ignorance syndrome, if you will, is one of the biggest arguments you can't get here from there. That's why I mentioned nuclear airplanes, fission nuclear rockets at Westinghouse. And people think you're talking about theoretical claptrap. Well, we operated one at the nuclear test site just outside Las Vegas, not far from Area 51, of course. The Westinghouse one had a power level of 1,100 megawatts. That's half the power of Hoover Dam.
This is a flying nuclear reactor.
No, it was ground tested.
Okay, but it was the idea
the
was
Nerva.
Ultimately okay. So it was Nerva.
Yeah, Nerva.
Okay.
And you
might describe how Nerva operated, because most people are not familiar with rockets, basically. But a nuclear rocket is one step more exotic. So.
Well, yeah, you have a big tank of liquid hydrogen, very cold. You pump it through a very exotic nuclear reactor, maybe 4 feet in diameter, 5 feet long, and it gets heated in the reactor to the point where the exhaust temperature is over 4,000 degrees.
Good heavens. Does that ionize the hydrogen?
No, it isn't ionized.
Oh, okay.
And the beauty of it is normal chemical rockets have a propellant and an oxidizer, hydrogen and oxygen, let's say. The heavy one is the oxygen. So if you can get rid of the oxygen, kerosene and oxygen, stuff like that, if you can get rid of the oxygen, you're way ahead of the game. So you have a high specific impulse. And you can triple the load. This is to be used as an upper stage, you understand. Not as a launch vehicle, but, third stage.
Sure,
and from there to Mars. You could triple the payload to Mars if you use a nuclear fission Nerva system as opposed to a chemical rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And Los Alamos, of course, ran the big daddy, the Phoebus 2B nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system. Power level was 4,400 megawatts, most powerful nuclear reactor ever tested in the free world. Again, Hoover Dam puts out 2,000 megawatts. Here's this little reactor sitting out there. You don't want to be near it when it's running. A lot of radiation.
But in space, who cares? Because the sun and cosmic rays and stars, space is where radiation belongs.
Well, yeah, but you got a pilot aboard someplace.
Exactly.
Shielding.
Either, so. Yeah, exactly. You got a shield. You have
shielding
to create a bubble.
Is a problem.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, as far as I know, those Nerva tests, actually produced a workable nuclear rocket. Most people don't know that, right, Stan?
How many do you want? They had
hours and hours, hundreds of hours. I forget how many hours they ran them. They certainly ran them the equivalent to dozens of missions, because you don't run, rockets.
Well, no, the limit on our ground test was set by the ability to store liquid hydrogen, because the longer you run the system, the hotter temperature-wise it gets, because there's radioactivity being produced. And I'll tell you, when I was listening, we had an inside broadcast, if you will, at Westinghouse. The test was out in Nevada. We were in Pittsburgh listening. And the kicker was, we had no idea how long would this thing last. Would the fuel elements cut out? I mean, over 4,000 degrees?
Mm.
We're talking unusual conditions.
Well, see, most people need to know that most rockets only burn for a few minutes, and then that's it.
Well, yeah, our limit was on the test would be an hour because of the need for having enough cooling, after cooling. And as we're listening, 5 minutes nominal temperature and pressure, and 10 minutes and 15 minutes, and gee, maybe this thing really is going to work. And I was particularly worried because just a couple of weeks before they had asked, Stan, can you tell us the heating rate in the control vanes? We don't want to melt them when we run the test, and we don't have any good data, so I had to crank up some unusual experiments down at our test facility and stuff. And so I was worried that, and I gave them some data, and they were very happy with the data. Yeah, we won't melt anything. And I was worried, if I was wrong, those darn control elements might melt, and they're going to blame it all on me. So it was with great delight that we got to the full hour test, nominal temperature and pressure. I mean, I say nominal. You're talking about exhaust at better than 4,000 degrees. Now, that's hot.
In terms of efficiency compared to a conventional chemical rocket, how much more efficient was the Nerva design?
Well, like I say, you could triple the payload to Mars compared to a chemical rocket.
Okay, so, or you could say triple the gas mileage or, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
you could,
yeah, okay. Yeah, we're not. Now, I should add that the real exciting system for deep space travel is nuclear fusion. And we did a study at Aerojet General Nucleonics for the Air Force, $9 million. Can you use fusion for deep space travel? Yeah, you can. There were new developments on superconducting magnets that suddenly made that feasible. And so, but here's the progression I want to get at. 10-ton bomb in 1944 on the B-29. 1945, the first nuclear weapons released the energy of approximately 16,000 tons of dynamite. So you go from 10 to 16,000. And in 1952, the first fusion device, nuclear fusion, just happens to be the most important source of energy in the universe. All the stars, that's what they're producing, is fusion energy. Our first H-bomb produced the energy of 10 million tons of TNT.
Was that the mic shot at Enewetok?
Yes.
Okay.
That's, yes.
Incredible. So you've got 16,000, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent.
And it didn't end there. The Russians tested one that was
57?
57.
57 megs. Oh, my God. Okay, so as a physicist, you have this background. How does it connect to UFOs? Because you must have at some point, Stan, said, wait a minute. These guys are not using rockets, nuclear, or any other kind of rocket. It ain't rockets. When did that epiphany occur?
Well, yeah, what I also realized, let's look at the real world. The Navy first nuclear submarine was 1956, Nautilus.
I thought it was 59. I think Nautilus 56. Is 59. Really? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Westinghouse.
All right. Oh, that's true. That's true. Okay. All right.
But the interesting thing is, many people don't realize, you know, we all heard all about the German U-boats during World War II, what a tremendous danger they were, convoys of ships going across and all that sort of thing. They didn't realize a U-boat could stay underwater for about a day at most because it needed oxygen for the diesel engines. People you can get oxygen for, and diesel engines, another story. Okay. With a nuclear-powered submarine, you go around the world underwater without coming to the surface. The Triton did it 60 days. They went around the world in 1960. Now, the Navy also developed something else, and that gets us a little closer to the how do you get from the stars. Nuclear-powered aircraft carriers can operate for 18 years without refueling. 18 years. You don't need to worry about the gas station.
But they do have to worry about gas stations for the jet fuel for the aircraft.
Well, yeah, but they use the space that they would use for fuel for themselves.
Exactly, for the jets.
Yeah. Now, but that's the point is this. On the water, you got a big mammoth aircraft carrier. It carries 75 little airplanes that can operate for, 2 hours without refueling. Now, if you're going from another star here, you use a fusion device, you can kick particles out the back end of a fusion rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in the dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. And fusion is what produces the energy in all the stars. Not just some of them, not just an occasional one, but all those 200 billion stars in the galaxy and those billions of galaxies. Those stars are fusioning. Now, we don't have a long history with fusion. We smart, arrogant Earthlings, somebody finally figured out that's how the sun produces its energy. They thought it was burning gas. And in 1938. So we joined the fusion community, if you will. I'm presuming every society that gets technological is going to want to figure out what the heck is going on in that big ball down there, the star in our solar system. It turns out to be fusion. And we forget. We didn't even know there were neutrons until 1932.
That's true.
You know, advanced civilization? Well, Johnny come latelys, I would say.
Okay. Why don't we stop there for a moment? We're at the top of the hour, 2 o'clock here in the Land of Enchantment. On a very, very frosty morning. It's in the early 20s in the early dawn. Ooh. My guest this morning is Stanton Friedman. This is Bobby Bright in the background. We'll be back at you very soon, so don't go away. We shall return.
Every life in limbo got a hold on me. Kites are on the table, paper on the sea. Rearrange their places, Lord. Set me free. Living in limbo, living in hell. Living in limbo, I know it too well. In limbo, I got my degree.
And we are back on a frosty morning in the Land of Enchantment with my guest all the way from a little tiny town called, what, Fredericton?
It's not tiny. It got 50,000 people.
Oh,
it's
my
metropolis.
God. I used to live outside a place called Frederick, Maryland, probably the same route, same guy, and it was tiny. It had like 5, 10,000 people. 50,000, my God, that's almost a town. Okay, one thing. You and I were both wrong. According to the Miss M, invaluable Miss M, producer of The Other Side of Midnight, the USS Nautilus, SSN-571, was the world's first operation of nuclear-powered submarine. The vessel was the first submarine to complete a submerged transit of the North Pole on, drum roll, 3 August 1958.
Yeah, that's of the North Pole. I was talking about going around the world.
Oh, no, no, that was the Trident. I was talking about the Nautilus going under the North Pole and under the ice.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe.
Yeah, it was an exciting.
It was exotic and exciting. And look, Stan, look, your background is nuclear. Are you aware of the possibilities of physics beyond nuclear for propulsion of interstellar spacecraft? In other words, at what point did you look at this technology and say, wait a minute, even as amazing as nuclear is, it can't measure up to what we need to get from here to the nearest star?
But we can. It can.
Well, but not in terms of a useful human lifetime. And in terms of probes and...
Let's throw some facts in here.
Okay,
at 1G
I like
acceleration,
facts.
It takes less than a year to get close to the speed of light. And if you go 99.9% of the speed of light, you can do 37 light years in 6 months pilot time. That's two nines after that, 99.99.
Okay.
You go out, come back, marry your granddaughter's best friend. Hey, that's the real world. I don't make these things up. My mantra, if I had one, is technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. And it's the assumptions that make the difference. There was a Canadian astronomer in 1941 in which he was sick and tired of all this nonsense about going to the moon. Science fiction writers were having a ball. he was going to show that that was nonsense. So he published a, quote, scientific, unquote, paper in a journal calculating the weight of a rocket to the moon. And he figured, and it was a legitimate question, how much is this thing going to weigh if you want to get a man to the moon and back? A million tons.
This is with chemical propulsion.
Yeah, yeah. And the kicker is he made every stupid assumption. We got three guys to the moon, but the rocket whose initial launch weight was only 3,000 tons. Mm. What makes a difference? Well, he assumed a single-stage rocket. We don't do that.
Right.
You use up a big tank of fuel, throw away the container. You know, I waste the energy. He assumed a limit of 1G acceleration. Well, the faster you get to orbit, the less energy it takes. And our astronauts routinely take 5Gs, and a trained pilot can perform a tracking task while being accelerated at 14Gs for, quite a sizable period of time.
Yeah, so also, basically his problem was the assumptions were all wrong, therefore the conclusion was all wrong. Garbage in, garbage out.
That's right. And I co-authored a book with Kathleen Martin called Science Was Wrong. 14 chapters. We each did 7. It was kind of a kick. And each chapter was stimulated by some very smart guy saying something very stupid. Mm-hmm. The top American astronomer in 1903, October, said that if there was one thing he was certain about, man would never find any difference, would never fly any distance in a vehicle. That was 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight.
Mm.
The British Astronomer Royal in 1956 said space travel is utter bilge. Nobody would ever pay the money, and what good would it do, and what we really need is better equipment for astronomy. That was a year before Sputnik, and the scientific field that's benefited the most from the space program has been astronomy.
Mm.
Think of the big telescope out there.
Hubble
telescope.
And the coming James Webb. Well, look, you're not telling me that science has reached an endpoint to where nuclear physics is the way that the guys are going to get between the stars, are you?
I'm not saying it's reached an endpoint.
Okay, so you're saying that we now have the capability, if we want to spend the money, to send a probe, et cetera, to Alpha Centauri within a reasonable period of time if we devoted a huge amount of effort. I'm talking about a physics that transcends the current limitations. Is there any data in all of these myriad multiple, you must have looked at thousands of reports. Stan, why didn't you get intrigued as I have with the physics of interstellar flight as opposed to...
I am
okay.
intrigued by it.
Okay,
but
good,
I started
good.
Where I know something about, and I know that we live in a universe that's energized, if you will, by nuclear fusion. If you want to go, all you got to do is spend the dough.
Yeah, but prior to 1938, when Hans Bethe on that train going north from New York had that insight, we lived in a universe where nuclear fusion didn't exist and the stars still shone. My point is there science beyond what we know that will make it incredibly more easy for these guys to get here? And is this kind of like a false canard that we don't have the physics to go between the stars? No, of course we don't. But that doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't.
Well, that is certainly true.
Okay.
I would expect that our visitors know more than we do. Now, some people can't accept that. If it's out there, we know about it. And, well, there's another part to this, Richard. Let's face it. There are some people who think that the only place research gets done is academia. And that's nonsense.
I've had
two different people tell me if Roswell happened, we'd have had to pull half the physics professors out of the universities to figure out what goes with those crash saucers.
Well, you know what Carl Sagan's great line to John Brandenburg was, don't you, during the whole Cydonia early investigation when Brandenburg was a member of our writing team on the paper and all that. Anyway, Brandenburg called Sagan up to ask him some question about Mars, and Sagan said to him, and this was so intriguing, it was so insightful, and the fact that John remembered it and we were able to write it down, Sagan said to John, remember, nuclear physicist, Sandia, all kinds of creds, you know, professional, colleague, whatever, Sagan said to John about Mars and what could be on Mars, it's not whether you're right or wrong, sir. You're not even in the conversation. What they've done, Stan, is they've excluded all of us that aren't in academia from the conversation. They've created a false reality. They've sold it like Trump to the American people. And the reason I wanted to talk to you tonight on the show is, what do we do different? Because if you keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result, you and I both know where that joke goes.
Yeah. No, there's no question that the academics know nothing about deep space travel. And it's not just about deep space travel. A whole bunch of other things they don't know anything about. Look, the stealth aircraft, keeping secrets, $10 billion in 10 years. And there were. That's the other thing. You can't get here from there, and the government can't keep secrets. How often have you heard that? I have heard it often.
Well, I've heard it often, and I don't believe it because I happen to know secrets.
Well, it's not
nobody...
true.
Yes.
I've worked on secret programs, and like I say, we spent $10 billion on stealth in secret. Another example of keeping secrets where you'd think, well, why did they do that? During World War II, the Brits broke the German codes. And so we set up a group at Bletchley Park in England. 12,000 people eventually worked there, picking up, decoding, translating, and quietly distributing classified German information.
This was the whole Enigma secret.
That's the whole Enigma secret.
Yeah.
Okay. And it worked very well.
Now, wait a minute. You know the story. I don't know whether it's apocryphal. I tried to trace it down that because we had cracked, when I say we, I mean the Allies, the British had cracked the code, that's a thing we wanted to keep from the Germans and the Nazis, most of all that we cracked the code. So the story goes that I'm trying to remember what major city in England was going to be bombed, and Churchill got wind of it through the code. And he couldn't let them know because that would have tipped off the Nazis that they had cracked the code.
Coventry,
yes. Is that story real? In other words, even if the story is only apocryphal, to me, what it says is there are secrets that are so important to a civilization, they are willing to let a lot of people die to keep that secret. That's what that meta message is. So in the UFO area, are there secrets attached to the technology, to everything that are so important as viewed by the opinion makers and the policy makers of our civilization, Stan, that despite your efforts over decades and mine and all the other people we all know, it hasn't changed because the powers that be think this is the worst thing they could ever announce, ever?
It's the cosmic Watergate. They've been lying about it, and incidentally, those 12,000 people at Bletchley Park, nobody said a word for 25 years. You'd think the war was over. Look what a great job we did.
You mean all the worker bees, all those 12,000 people who were just people, and they had cousins and aunts and families, and they bragged, and they did all the things human beings do. And all that time, not one of them revealed what they really had worked on that changed everything.
Secrets can be kept, and big budgets are out there proving it. Well, our first spy satellite, the Corona spy satellite, they knew that the U-2 wouldn't last forever. We were using it to spy on the Russians in violation of international law, all that sort of stuff. And it flew higher than their rockets could get to when we started. But eventually their rockets got better, and we know about Gary Powers and all that sort of stuff. But they were already set in motion the development of a better system, a Corona spy satellite. I get a kick out of it, that being the town where the Roswell crash happened. You know, anyway.
I'm not quite sure it was named after
failures.
Corona.
They had 12 failures in a row.
Yep.
Number 13 worked. And that first one, this is a satellite now, so it's going round and round and round, and it's legal. You're above the horizon, so to speak.
Well, Eisenhower had made a proposal to Khrushchev called Open Skies. When Khrushchev turned him down, all Eisenhower did was turn to the CIA and said, make it so. And they put an aerial platform 100-something miles upstairs above the atmosphere where the Russians couldn't touch it, and we took pictures.
Well, and you know how we got the film back?
Oh, yes.
We deorbited the film canister. Can you imagine? What's your job? Well, I fly out in the Pacific, and when this spy satellite is sending back its film, we catch it with a big net.
Yeah, they had this big C-130 cargo aircraft, and they had pincers up front that caught the cable of the balloon of the spacecraft as it was coming down. It had, like, parachutes and a cable, and they snagged it in midair and then reeled it inside, and then they developed the film back at the, you know, headquarters.
You realize we didn't tell the world, I mean, the Russians knew, they weren't going to tell their people, that we had done something better than they had for 30 years.
Yep.
And so can secrets be kept? Yes.
Well, do you remember who?
Lots of money, you bet your boots.
Do you remember who declassified a lot of the Corona photography for the first time in his administration? Bill Clinton.
Oh,
that's how long it took for the. I mean, you can now see Corona imagery of the Washington Monument taken on film, deorbited, snagged by an airplane over the Pacific, rushed back to a laboratory, developed in a photographic laboratory, and then made into prints and negatives and transparencies and all that. I mean, the technology for the time was eerie, but it basically, I think, Stan, it's true that without that reconnaissance technology, we probably would have died in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union.
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Do you know who else agreed with me and you on that? A good old nemesis of yours, Philip Klass.
Yeah, he wrote a book about reconnaissance.
Yeah.
And Philip, they couldn't prosecute him about his breaking security because they didn't want to reveal
it. Yep. Okay, somewhere it's rumored that you have said, and I want to talk about this for the remainder of the show, and I'm going to have some people join us at the bottom of the hour and ask you questions that I'm not good enough to think of. Is it true that your feeling is disclosure would be the worst thing possible?
Well, I haven't rated it that way, but I'm certainly not pushing for disclosure.
Well, I've heard that you think it would lead to chaos, and the technology from the saucers would not be released. It would be a, in other words, kind of spin out that scenario. Why is disclosure, which all of us want, why is your opinion that maybe it's not what we should want?
Well, because we're not prepared on our planet. You may have noticed that this year we'll spend $1 trillion on things military. We are not a very trusting society. And so why in the world would the Russians or the Chinese or the Americans release the technology they've learned from crash saucers if the other guy doesn't? And why would anybody release technology that could be of use to some other guy? And we all have other guys. Look, Pakistan and India share a border. They both have nuclear weapons. The last thing they need is something that, you know, changes the whole balance of power.
But wait. This is interesting because in the current scenario, with each nation state fiercely guarding its little piece of, you know, alien ET technology, and the other side not knowing how advanced this technology that we've found and the we as anybody, so you have all these competing groups and each one is suspicious of the other. That sounds to me like a dynamic, stand that's incredibly unstable. Whereas if you pooled your resources, if everybody was forced somehow to share what they knew and got what the other guys knew in a kind of a global consortium where everyone is looking at the same data, isn't that more stable?
Well, it undoubtedly would be. But why are we spending $1 trillion this year on things military? Because we don't trust anybody.
Okay.
I mean, look, from an alien viewpoint, we killed 50 million people during World War II. We destroyed 1,700 cities. We have exploded, since the war, 2,000-plus nuclear warheads. Only two dropped on people, thank goodness.
Mm.
Many people forget that there were lots of tests of nuclear warheads, and they leave residue, so I think the aliens would be paying attention to that. And with our track history, I mean, it boggles the mind. And I wonder if school kids learn that, oh, we only killed 50 million people during the war. What's 50 million people between friends? Well, we're not friends on this planet. And what has kept us from going to war with each other is we know enough about what the other guy is doing so that, you know, it's check and check, me versus you and you versus me and so forth. But you know, all it takes is one idiot And I hate to say it, but we've had our share of idiots on this planet.
Yes, and we're still here. I mean, during the 50s, remember when the NORAD detected, NORAD detected the moon, and they thought it was a fleet, a salvo of missiles coming over the pole from the old Soviet Union, and it was like within seconds, well, maybe minutes, that they actually clarified that, no, it was a bounce off the moon that was giving a false signal. But that situation, the Cold War, was really incredibly unstable, and this situation, yeah. If we're all pursuing super high tech from crash saucers or from contacts, or I mean, how do we know the guys out there aren't playing each one off against the other one like we did in Vietnam, or we're doing in the Mideast, or, you know, Roddenberry wrote about in Star Trek?
We don't know.
Exactly.
We don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know. And what I'm saying is, it's nice to talk about disclosure. And what I would envision as a possible scenario, and that reveals the reasons you don't want to disclose, would be for people, highly trusted individuals on the planet. My favorite odd couple is the Queen and the Pope, saying that we have it on good authority that alien visitors are coming to the planet, and we are announcing half a dozen international conferences dealing with the religious, the psychological, the practical aspects of this. What would happen? Church attendance would go up, mental hospital admissions would go up, the stock market would go down because any uncertainty drops the market. And we'd go on about our business, but not in the same way that we had been. But one other thing that would happen, the young generation has no trouble with their, I found, and maybe you found different, with the idea that there are beings out there. And everybody tells me, oh, we can't be the only ones. Mm. But they don't realize that for a lot of years there were a lot of big shots saying we were the only ones.
Well, it swings back and
if
forth.
If there were other people out there, we would know about it. Because they'd want to talk to us. We smart guys. Mm-hmm. You know, we professors of astronomy. We SETI cultists, as I call them. Mm. They haven't asked for an appointment, so they must not be coming here. And look, this paper, I just wrote an article about it for these guys from Australia National University, where we're probably the only ones in the whole galaxy because civilizations, before life can develop to a civilization start, it's got to change things on the planet to be suitable for life to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's probably nobody out there. And we're it. What arrogant ignorance.
Well, but wait,
you know,
well,
as if they had sent visitors.
Stan, wait a minute. It's actually a very interesting idea. Because for one thing, it does answer the Fermi question. You know, where is everybody?
Yeah, but remember, one of the reasons I went to the University of Chicago is because Fermi was there. And you won't believe the respect with which he was held by his contemporaries. I was at school there when he died. Exploratory surgery, was riddled with cancer, and he died.
Was it because of his experiments with the piles and all that?
Well, probably before that. He got a Nobel Prize for radiating things with neutrons and seeing what happened.
Right.
And, neutrons and people don't get along very well.
Nope. Nope.
if you have enough of them. But Fermi was famous on campus for asking questions as a teaching tool. So when he left that meeting and he said, "Where is everybody?"
Right.
Luncheon at Los Alamos. Sounds like a title for a movie, doesn't it?
Or a wonderful grade B sci-fi horror movie that I love watching. Like, remember the one with the ants? The radiation in the ants?
Yes. Anyway, what they had talked about, it would only take a few million years to colonize the whole galaxy. And then they went on to other things at lunch. And as they were leaving, Fermi said, "So where is everybody?" And everybody knew what he was talking about. He didn't say there's nobody coming here. He asked a sensible question. And one good answer is, we don't know where everybody is, but we know that some of them have been coming here, and the government knows a great deal about them. Fermi knew you could keep secrets. He was working on the nuclear weapons, the first nuclear chain reaction, done in a squash court under the stadium at the University of Chicago, in a real exotic setting, was done by Fermi. So he knew about keeping secrets. I'm not saying whether he knew about saucers through inside or not. I don't know. my answer to the question, and there are whole books about answers to the question, but is we don't know where everybody is, but we know some of them are coming here, and the government knows a great deal about them and isn't telling us. But in our arrogance, the government wouldn't hide it from us. I just read an article by a guy named Markowitz way back in the 60s, and he said the notion that there is that people would cover up such knowledge is absurd. The fame and fortune from being the first to announce being extraterrestrial beings would be impossible for anybody to resist, and so you could never keep it secret.
Yeah, I call this the NASA gold card test.
Good, I like it.
You may steal freely.
Okay. And what I'm getting at here is that it sounds easy. Aren't we entitled to know everything? My answer is, first of all, we're not entitled to know everything. And we also, sometimes deception is important. I mean, I hate to say it, but governments lie intentionally to deceive their enemies. Good example, World War II. We spent a lot of effort convincing Hitler that the attack on Europe by the Allies would take place down near Calais.
Totally.
And so when they landed at Normandy, the generals asked Hitler to send in the reserves. No, that's a feint. That's not a real landing. It's really going to come down here. So don't let those reserves go because we're going to need them. He waited too long when they finally realized. But if they hadn't fooled him, things might have gone very differently during the war. We came close to getting our tail kicked in the war. And deception was part of what kept us going. And that may sound terrible to some people, I guess. You mean you had a lie? Yeah, sometimes you got a lie. They even stuck papers in the jacket of a guy who had died, and they dumped him off Spain because they knew the Spanish would pass it to Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cleverly worded papers, the man without a face, I guess it was. It was the name of the book. And cleverly worded, it wasn't blatant. But any sensible intelligence agent, and certainly the Germans had plenty of those, would have presumed that they're talking about Calais. Huh.
Well, see, you also, Stan, need to kind of back off to an interstellar point of view and say, if we do all this to each other down here, we're all one family, if we really have been interacting with real aliens, and I'm not so sure that we're not interacting with members of the family upstairs, because that has to do with the hidden and incredibly interesting lost solar system history that I've been looking at with a whole bunch of other people, and artifacts shown up now in all kinds of imagery from Mercury to Pluto. In other words, if this solar system really did house an incredibly advanced civilization, and they're now gone, and we're all that's left, and we're not doing too well. Remember the 1 to 2 trillion we spend killing everybody every year? Well, the guys who wrote the paper, the thing that intrigued me about the paper is it's the first statement post-Sagan that maybe all us advanced cultures, and I'm obviously making a huge step by putting us in the all, don't make it. And what if we tried figuring out what it is that kills them off before they get past the gateway, and can that gateway to whoever is out there be used to keep us from following the same horrible future history?
Well, I think there may be a rule about how much you can interfere with the society. If
Prime
you look at Robert, if you look at Bob Salas's story about the nuclear-tipped missiles, they didn't explode them.
No, they just demonstrated how incredibly impotent the most advanced weapons on Earth were in the face of an even more advanced technology. Hold it there. We are now at the bottom of the hour, last half hour with my guest this morning, Stanton Friedman. We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff with you guys now. So if you want to call in, I'll give you the numbers when we come back. You're on the other side of midnight. We're talking. I want to get more into this, how disclosure might not be the most interesting and positive development that could happen on this planet. And we'll do that when we come back. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
That I'll always stay with you, but baby, that's not me. You need someone. willing to give their heart and soul to you. Promise you forever, babe, that's something I can do. Oh, I could say that I'll be all you need. That would be a lie. I know I'd only hurt you. I know I'd only make you cry.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. Just a few minutes left in this morning's show. We've got a caller. Where are you calling from? Hello?
I'm calling from Ontario.
Ah, and you are?
It's Michael.
Michael, what would you like to ask?
I've talked to you before.
Yes, Michael, what would you like to ask Stan?
You know what? It's the same thing. I've had some people on Twitter, and they're arguing again, and they want Stan to tell his stand about the flat earth theory, and I hate this.
Then why are you calling and asking him about it? It's nonsense.
Well, because I know how you guys can really put this to rest. I'd like to hear you guys put it to rest.
Stanton, are you up for this? I'm not.
Well, I did a couple of shows recently against my better judgment, and I'm not going to do any more.
Okay.
Spending time on the flat earth, because some of the arguments I heard were so silly, and because...
I know, it's...
Well, the
you know,
simplest...
It's really a waste of our time,
the
really.
Simplest,
I just like these people to realize that it's how dumb,
the simplest
how
argument
stupid.
Is, the simplest argument is if we lived on a flat earth, if it was a platter, like an LP record... How in the world do we launch spacecraft to take close-up images of round planets?
Oh, but we don't.
But we don't.
We don't. Remember, no, all those space things, that's all phony. That was one of the things that got to me. I know several astronauts. Edgar Mitchell wrote the foreword to my
mm-hmm.
book, Flying Saucers in Science, for example. And I met Buzz Aldrin and others. And the notion that all these guys are lying, none of them went into space. They didn't go to the moon.
Oh,
they didn't,
really, you know. Eh?
Yeah, and so there's a whole bunch of this stuff, and they have very elaborate. Antarctica is a wall around this flat disk. And I did a couple of shows because I'd committed myself foolishly to do them.
It sounds to me like you need to look before you leave.
Well, and I can understand the Hollow Earth. The Hollow Earth and stuff, but not the Flat Earth.
What can I say? There's a whole cult of people out there who are convinced that the moon and the sun are the same size. And it's just a long, sad story, and I will not do another show about the Flat Earth.
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe it either.
Okay.
So
is that
anyway,
your question?
I've got a better one out there. I'm thinking that, you know, all the fireballs and the things I've seen, the UFOs and possibly alien fireballs could be connected and scientifically explained.
Well, I'm not saying most things have explanations if you work hard at it. We're just not smart enough in the past to have known all at the time. Because, you know, we are not at the end of our quest for knowledge. Every generation of scientists stands up and says, we know all that there is to know. And they're wrong. They've consistently been wrong.
Totally. Totally. It's almost the only thing you can count on, that they'll be wrong.
Yeah.
Wasn't it Arthur Clarke who said, if an elderly and distinguished scientist says to you that something is right... if something is impossible, he is most likely wrong. And if he says that it's correct, he most likely will underestimate when it will come to pass by decades.
Yeah, Arthur Clarke said that. He doesn't believe in flying saucers, you understand.
I know, yes.
And I have a chapter in my book about that.
Okay.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but Stan, but I believe you two scientists disprove all that. And because these other people say this and that, I think there's going to be some kind of really big thing coming up here, And I think we're going to see some proof here, and I think Rich is going to be proven right.
Well, that'd be nice.
Well, who knows what will be. All I know is there will be new science if we survive, and that there are new things coming along. I mean, as I've said to somebody, you know, I don't use the slide rule anymore. I did when I started work in industry, and I said that to a group of students.
And they said...
I didn't get it. They said, what's a slide
exactly.
rule, basically? I asked. I didn't see any reaction. So I asked, does anybody know what a slide rule was? And in that group of about 100 students,
I often do
classroom appearances before an evening.
Well, lecture. The future is just, it's asymptotic. I mean, the idea that we will not know, Stan, you know, you're a little older than I am, but I really think, along with Michael, that we're going to know a lot more in a very short period of time because all the signs point to 2016, 2017 being some kind of political decision date. So, Michael, let me thank you for being part of the program.
Oh, it's not even just about a political day or something. I think it's really about your research, Richard, and your pictures that you've done and your research on the crystalline structures on the edges of the... you know, I think it's going to be proven soon. I have a feeling.
Well, we'll see. Anyway, Michael, thank you.
Exciting time to be alive.
Incredibly exciting. So let me get back to the question. If you really don't think disclosure is a good idea, I don't want to put you on a spot, Stan, but you've spent decades trying to unburden the culture of this horrible secret that will change everything. If you don't think the change is beneficial, why have you been pursuing it so long?
Because I want people to change their attitudes about where we fit in the scheme of things. I think it's important that we recognize that we're not alone. That's different from saying the government needs to tell us everything it knows.
Okay.
I don't think we know how to handle it.
So you think that philosophically and culturally, if the government were, without revealing all the messy details, you know, the technologies that would destroy the Earth tomorrow, that kind of thing, if they just announced that we have company, we have relatives, we're not all by ourselves in the Milky Way, you think that in itself would be a trigger to positive change?
Well, yeah, but remember, I recognize the difficulties. What does it mean to religion? Not a trivial question.
Not at all.
I mean, the fundamentalists say all the intelligent people in the universe who have language are on Earth, and the UFOs are the work of the devil. And everything was created in 4004 B.C., so 6,000 years ago. And this is definitely wrong. But there is also the question, how do you convert a world spending $1 trillion this year on things military to one in which that money actually goes to feed the starving kids, for example?
Stan, have you thought of the idea that if we could somehow get disclosure that very fact would cause all these other nations, all these other peoples, all these other humans to say, who the hell am I compared to? And they would start to relate to human beings as family and the other as the real other, and it may reset everything.
Well, it could reset everything, but what I'm concerned about is how do we get them on our side is going to be, you know, we're nations. Nationalism is the only game in town.
On this planet.
And there's... Nobody in power wants to give up power. You may have noticed that.
Well, that's not quite true, because during the Russian Revolution, the new one, when Yeltsin took over and resigned, we can hear you, just wait a minute, and all the Politburo got in their, you know, Russian luxury limousines and drove to their dakas and left the government to Yeltsin.
Yeah.
It did happen. So if it happened once with the immutable, insuperable, unstoppable Soviet Union, couldn't this problem also be something we've created in our own minds? I mean, who's to say that the guys out there, A, are covetous, like in, you know, H.G. Wells, B, really want us to interact with them a lot anyway, and certainly would not come trillions of miles to eat, because they could make restaurants much quicker at home. So What's the big reason why we don't know we're not alone tonight, Stan, having based all these years in the vineyards looking at a lot of classified documents?
I think the big reason is the unwillingness of the military to tell us what's going on, and the unwillingness of the ancient academics and fossilized physicists who keep insisting that there's nothing to know. And they'd have to admit that they've been wrong all this time. Nobody wants to admit they've been wrong. Look, Carl Sagan and I were classmates for 3 years at Chicago, and he still had the gall, I'll say, to say that there are interesting UFO sightings that aren't reliable. There are reliable UFO sightings that aren't interesting, but there are no interesting and reliable sightings. He said that in two books. Now, that's total nonsense. The biggest study ever done showed exactly the opposite, but Carl doesn't give any references. The ancient academics have no reason to study the evidence. When I was on David Susskind, remember he had a talk
show? Oh, my God, David Susskind, yes.
I got called. I was in California. You know, there'd been the coin case that happened. And anyway, he wanted me to do a lot of stuff for them and get them a good skeptic. I said, there aren't any, but I can tell you how to reach Phil Klass. abductee, and I got him Betty Hill, and they wanted me to send them all kinds of stuff. So I took care of all of that. I go to New York, and while we're taping, and there was no live audience, so he said, made a comment. I was sitting next to him. He said, look, I read the New York Times, and I don't see anything at all in there that says these things are real, so I'm not going to waste my time on something that isn't real. The Susskind syndrome is, if I keep up with what's going on in the world, if these things are real, it would be important. If it were important, I would know about it, and I don't, so it must not be. So there must be nothing to it. That's what I call the kind of crazy thinking.
Okay, I will see your Susskind story and raise you one Ted Koppel. When I met Ted, you know, several years ago in the Nightline Studios in Washington,
yeah,
he looked at me because I'm laying out my case that NASA's not been telling us the truth. You know, another government agency not telling us the truth. What a surprise! And he looked at me at the end of, like, what, half an hour, and I had some slides, and I, you know, it was a lot of, you know, show and tell, basically very intimate, just around a conference table. It wasn't a presentation. It was just, you know, a few guys, his staff, me, some of my folks, and him. At the end of the presentation, he looked at me, and he says, but Dick, if this was going on, I would know about it.
He did say that.
Well, absolutely!
I did his show. Phil Klass and I were on his show together. Together is a loose worm there. And incidentally, we did it differently. We were told to, we were sitting about 2 feet apart.
Yep.
Each had our own camera. Don't look at each other. Look at your camera. We never saw Ted, only through an earpiece. And that was strange in and of itself. But he said, Washington is notoriously leaky. You can't keep secrets around here.
Yep.
And that's the arrogance of the media.
But see, if media superstars like Ted, and I probably shouldn't say things about him on the show because I'm trying to get him on the show to talk about his new book, which is all about, you know, EMP, which is an incredibly interesting problem to discuss with Ted Koppel. Anyway, I didn't fault him for the attitude, because when you're in that chair, when you're in that position, Stan, they do make you think like you're God, and you cannot even know if a sparrow falls in Rock Creek Park, you'll hear about it, that kind of thing. So I didn't attribute his statement to arrogance, as just the reality of the universe in which he lived, in which nothing of importance he did not know, therefore, if it was important, back to what David Susskind told you, and that's the trap they keep these stars in, because they don't know what they don't know.
Well, that's right, and there are a number of people connected with the government who say, I'm so important, here I am in Washington, if this were true, I would know about it.
Yeah, well...
And the point is that's simply nonsense, and you don't keep secrets by telling a lot of people and hope they all shut up. and the penalties for breaking security are pretty rough. And so you become very conscious of that. I had a clearance for 14 years, and I'll never forget. I was giving a presentation at a classified radiation shielding meeting, and I needed to have my slides with me. And they didn't get him ready in time. but and the courier had left. So they made me a courier. I mean, I obviously had a need to know for what was on my slides.
Mm-hmm.
And they sat me down, and there are some rules here, Mr. Friedman, and these slides stay with you all the time.
So you had the briefcase and the chain and the thing around your wrist and all?
Well, no chain.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, it stays with you, not in the trunk of the car, and they paint a terrible picture. And if the plane crashes, we don't care about you, but we care about the classified material. And, you know, I was never so glad to get rid of something in my life. It was just uncomfortable. And I worked with classified stuff every day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's another thing that happens. If you leave a classified document out at night in a secure area, mind you, the guards go around and check. And if you left a document out, you get a call, 11 o'clock at night, come in and itemize your files, inventory your files. If you do that a second time, you get a real problem, and the third time you're out.
Hmm.
And so you become very concerned about... I remember once I got just a confidential document. For some reason, Convair Fort Worth sent it to me at my home. I opened this envelope totally innocently, and my God, here's a classified document. I was so worried when I went to work that day, if I had a crash, somebody's going to say I'm stealing.
And that's how you'll be known in history forever.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is you take security seriously. It's your job, you know, family, and you can be, I'm, what, 11 years older than you, I think, and so I remember World War II and loose lips sink ships, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And so I lived in Linden, New Jersey, not far from where you grew up. But we were worried during the war. We had Standard Oil around the waterfront. And if the German submarines tossed enough missiles, bombs out there, they might start a fire. And we were producing 90% of the high-octane fuel used by the Allies during World War II.
Mm.
And so the notion that somebody might find out something that would do you damage was real.
Have you been watching this WGN series called Manhattan, about the Manhattan Project? It's a fictional.
No, I haven't been.
I recommend find it on Blu-ray, find it, you know, somewhere, and watch the whole thing, because the secrecy, and they have duplicated that whole mindset of secrecy during the war, General Groves and the whole Los Alamos, I mean, exquisite programming, writing, acting. It gives you a feeling for the period where secrecy was everything. So when Roswell happened, that secrecy was ready stand to be moved sideways to kill any discussion of whatever happened at Roswell. So
let me give you one quick example. You mentioned General Groves. His wife gets a call on August the 6th from General Groves' office at the Pentagon, from an assistant in the office. And he thought, he was under instructions from General Groves to call her because he thought she might be interested in what would be on the news at noon, radio, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, she tunes in, and they announce that the first atomic bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima and the war would be over soon. And she thought, their son was due to be sent to the Pacific, not something they looked forward to. And she thought that was the reason why she'd been told to listen to the radio. Well, the last line on the broadcast was that this development of this incredible new weapon was under the direction of General Leslie Groves. That's when she found out what he'd been doing for the previous 3 years.
Yeah.
It's an interesting story.
Oh, this series so exquisitely explores the dynamics and the relationship. You got to see this because it'll bring back a lot of memories, Stan. We have someone on the line. Good morning. What would you like to ask Mr. Friedman?
Yes, hello, Stan.
Hi.
And Mr. Hoagland, glad to see you guys. Stanton Friedman, I respect your work. In fact, you and I have met over the years, years ago, back during the Project Awareness days in the late to mid-90s. And we also did an interview on the air for a show called Reality Check. And I definitely followed all of the work you guys have done as far as extraterrestrials and Mr. Hogan, a lot of the great work you've done with the structures on the moon, things like that. Over the last year, I've come across some information, and it kind of ties back into the last call. I know you guys are probably tired of hearing about this, but it's just not going away.
You're not talking about flat Earth, are you?
I watched a rocket launch 75 miles up over Arizona at 11 o'clock in the morning. On that video, it shows the moon and the sun both 75 miles up over Arizona at 11 o'clock in the morning. At that time, the moon should have been on the other side of the planet, over Australia. It's documented. I can send the video to you guys. How is that possible if the sun is 93 million miles away on one side of the planet and the moon is 238,000 miles away on the other side of the planet? I'm just wondering because this has really got me confounded as well.
Well,
and I'm
hang
really
on,
trying to prove
on.
The ball again.
No, no. Stan, you want to track at it? Because I have a story that might feed into this.
I missed part of that question. What was on the opposite side of what?
Okay.
They fired a rocket up.
75 miles over Arizona during the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning. In the video, at 75 miles up, you see the sun and you see the moon, both, at the same time. If the moon should have been over Australia at that time, according to all the data on the computer for that day and that time, how is that possible to see both of those objects over when one should be completely on the opposite side of the Earth?
I don't see why
Earth.
It should be on the opposite side of the Earth.
Well, it was. The video I've watched shows this guy doing the
well, I think...
He looks at the date and time and shows where the moon will be,
think,
and it will be over Australia. I'm sorry.
I think you may have a problem with scale. Because when you toss a rocket up to 75 miles, even if the moon is on the other side of the planet geometrically from where the sun is, mm-hmm. At that altitude, you can look across the curvature of the Earth, and since if it's not exactly opposite, I mean,
okay.
Objects, the Earth geometrically would not be in the way, so I can think of a geometry where you'd be able to see all that on the video. Do me a favor, send me the video, I'll take a look at it, I'll look at the angles. I have a feeling there's a very simple explanation, and it's simply because most people are not familiar with how things look when they're looked at from space.
Well, that's what we keep being told. It's all about height and how high up we can go. I mean,
well,
75
that's
miles,
true.
That's not high enough to see the curve. And the video shows flat as well.
Well, it also, hang on, it also depends on how much it's zoomed. I can show you astronaut pictures taken from the space station where if you zoom in to sunrise and the sun is half a degree wide from the Earth, the horizon looks flat. Even though if you back out, if you zoom out, you can see it's curved, depending upon the data. And if you're getting full data or partial data, you don't have, I don't think, enough data to decide geometrically what it is you saw because you don't have some of the background required to fill in the pieces, fill in the blanks.
Okay. I'll give you that.
Yeah,
okay,
I have another question. Send me the video and I'll go through it.
I certainly will.
All right, and I will send you back. Stan, that's what we try to do here, clear up little mysteries.
Well, let me give you an example of something that confused a lot of people. Marconi, first long-distance radio transmission to Newfoundland, 1901. Now, everybody said, look, radio waves move in straight lines. The greatest distance, because it's round Earth, you know, the radio waves will run into the Earth, so you can only go a couple hundred miles before you can't see them.
Yep.
Now, Marconi had been running tests from ships out at sea and stuff, and he knew that wasn't true. So it was more than 20 years later before they found out about the ionosphere, that it was reflecting, if you want to use it that way, the radio waves. We didn't know it was there. So it was impossible, but it was real. And when you find something that shouldn't be, you better check to see. Maybe you don't know enough to say that it shouldn't be. You missed something.
Yeah.
Well, I've really spent 10 months trying to prove the ball. I really have. I didn't want this to be something. I didn't want this to be something I had to fret over. Believe me, I've been on the ball my whole life. But over the last 10 months, I have looked and looked for some conclusive proof that doesn't start with spherical geometry, that doesn't take orbital mechanics, that can't explain this new planet that circles. How does a planet circle that's 20,000 years away from us and come back? Well, be drawing one thing, everything one that's 20,000 years away from us.
Actually, I think that orbit of that planet, if they really find it, is going to be 25,920. And, sir, we are at the end of the show, so I'm going to goodnight you. I have a few things.
Well, thank you guys for the call. I appreciate your time, gentlemen. I do, like I said, I appreciate all the work you've done over the years. I just hope you look further into this flat Earth thing.
Send me the video.
You got it, brother. I will send it to you. Thanks a lot.
Flat Earth out. Okay.
And my website is www.stantonfriedman.com.
In the few minutes we've got left, we've got maybe a minute here, hit the book again. Why should we go out and buy this new Aztec book? What was Aztec, and why should we know about it?
There was a crash in March of 1948, and a big vehicle, 100 feet in diameter, crashed. And there were bodies on board. Government came in. I mean, Aztec is not a highly populated area, mm-hmm. to say the least. Grabbed it, took it away, apparently to Los Alamos at the beginning. And it's been demonstrated, and it is in the book, that you can get here from there, despite you broke it up a couple of times, but there are no choke.
What's the title of the book?
The title of the book is The Aztec UFO Incident. That's A-Z-T-E-C, Aztec. And it's by Scott Ramsey, Suzanne Ramsey, and Frank Thayer, and I wrote a preface.
Super.
And it just came out. I mean,
well, it's a very classic case. It was denied as being real for decades. Now nice to have an authoritative overview. You know, Stan,
yes.
I don't do UFOs because many, many years ago I decided that I didn't want to, you know, go through the incredible hurdles that you have looking at millions of pages of blanked out text. When you come back on
very
the next
exciting.
Show. Yeah. When we come back on our next show, I want to show you some pictures taken all around the solar system of some stunning things that do not belong in any NASA standard catalog. And we'll have fun deciding who may have left them and where they are now. Anyway, we're at the end of the show. My guest this morning, Stanton Friedman. We've had a wonderful time. We'll have more. It is Tuesday morning, everyone. Tomorrow morning, Wednesday, is Open Hailing Frequencies. We're going to discuss the possible earthquake politically that occurred in Iowa last night and where it could take us. Until then, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.